The Fretboard Journal podcast is brought to you by Bedstoo Shoes. Bedstoo makes shoes, boots, and sneakers for men and women that are sourced from nature, feature vegetable tan leathers. They employ recycled materials and plant-based dyes. Best of all, these handmade and hand-finished eco-friendly boots and shoes look fantastic and are built to last. I'm wearing a pair right now, as are some of our favorite musicians. Go to bedstoo.com to learn more about their products and tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. We are also brought to you by our friends at RetroFret Vintage Guitars. Go to retrofret.com to see their entire inventory. It is something to behold. A 1958 D'Angelico XL cutaway arch chop just arrived at their store. They also currently have a 57 Whiteguard Telecaster, a 59 Epiphone Texan, and a lot more. RetroFret is one of the most trusted shops in the country. They have one of the best repair divisions around, and I encourage you all to follow them. We're also brought to you by iZotope.com. If you're working with audio and need any iZotope software in your life, click on the link in the show notes and use the discount code FRET10 and you will save 10% off of your order. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am your host, Jason Verlinde. Our 49th issue of the magazine is out now and mailing to all of our subscribers. Thank you so much to everyone out there who has subscribed. John Reichman is in that issue. Mike Baghetta, Wandering Boy Guitars, Dr. Molly Miller, John Sebastian interviewed by Dick Boak, and a lot of other surprises. We are a reader-supported magazine. That's why our magazine looks and feels so different from most of the traditional magazines out there, especially the guitar magazines. So if you want to support us, if you want to support this podcast, the easiest way to do so is to join us as a subscriber. We've got digital subscriptions starting at just $30, and then we've got the print subscription if you want to get the keepsake collectible coffee table book edition of our magazine. However you do it, it all supports us. It all powers this podcast and everything else we do. And this podcast in particular, this week's, is one that's very close to my heart, and I'm super excited to share it with you. So J.D. Crowe, the legendary bluegrass band leader and banjo player, passed away on Christmas Eve 2021, basically almost exactly a year after his friend Tony Rice's passing. JD is one of those guys who had a huge influence on so many great players that we all follow, banjo players, guitar players, you name it. He bridged the old and new worlds of bluegrass. I mean, he started with Jimmy Martin, backing Jimmy Martin up. Then in 1975, he released this astounding album called J.D. Crowe and the New South, also known to those in the know as just Rounder Records 0044. This is a record that had J.D., Jerry Douglas, Tony Rice, Ricky Skaggs, and Bobby Sloan on it. It's incredible, and I urge you all to check it out. So J.D. passed. There were all these tributes online. I knew a bit about his music. I knew a bit about his legacy, but I never got to interview him. So I did what everybody does. I went down the Spotify and YouTube rabbit hole. I rediscovered and reacquainted myself with all of his great music. And I'll be honest, that New South record is so filled with talent and has so much great playing on it. I kind of forgot who was doing what. And so for today's podcast, I wanted to talk to somebody who actually knows their way around a banjo to hear a banjo player's perspective on J.D. Crowe. I turned to my dear friend, Bill Evans, who knew J.D. for decades. He actually posted a free J.D. Crowe banjo lesson on his Peghead Nation page, which I'll include a link to in the show notes. And he was actually, as I found out, about to start an instruction program with J.D. himself for Peghead Nation that sadly will never get done. I asked Bill to give us all a primer on all things J.D. Crowe, and as you'll hear, he pretty much delivered an hour-long masterclass on why J.D. was so important to our world of music. He even trotted out his old Gibson to show us how J.D. played differently than like Earl Scruggs. It's a great episode. I think Bill really did a great job of explaining the importance of J.D. Crowe to all of us civilians, and I hope you enjoy it. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Bill Evans. Classes in session, folks. We're going to learn all about J.D. Crowe. Bill, thank you for doing this. Thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast again. It's been a while.
Jason, it's great to hear you, and we can see each other, even though our listeners are just getting the audio, and I'm coming to you from Rio Doso, New Mexico. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, J.D. Crowe, bluegrass banjo legend, passed away on Christmas Eve, the age of 84, and I was racking my brain, going like, you know, who should I talk to? I want to pay tribute. I want to tell listeners and our readers a little bit more about what made him so important to the world of bluegrass and newgrass. And then I saw your post, and you did you've actually shared on Peghead Nation, our friends at Peghead Nation, a tutorial of one of his tunes, Blue Ridge Cabin. And I knew you guys go back. So here we are. I wanted to reach out to you and kind of just have you give us sort of the introduction as well as your thoughts on JD. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Jason. And, you know, 2021 was a year of tremendous loss for the bluegrass banjo world, especially. Not only J.D. Crowe passed away, but Sonny Osborne, another giant in the music. Bill Emerson, another very important player. And also Dennis Kaplinger, John Hickman, a terrible year. But J.D. Crowe's loss hit hard. For me personally, our relationship goes back to the 1970s. But we were about to start a series of workshops on Peghead Nation together. They were slated to start in January of 2022, and it was going to be the first video documentation of his banjo style and his approach. And he was up for it. He wanted to do it. He began to, his health began to seriously decline in October. We put it on hold. I encouraged him just to do everything he could to get well. He indicated that he wanted to do it. And as most folks know, his condition got worse and he passed away on Christmas Eve. I know for those who aren't totally into bluegrass, but kind of see it as something that is maybe one of a myriad of interests that they might have musically. And your readers are likely to be very aware of Tony Rice and Clarence White, and then some of the young phenomenons, Chris Eldridge, Julian Laga has a somewhat of a relationship with acoustic music and bluegrass. And so if you're peripherally related to bluegrass and you see, you read all these glowing tributes about J.D. Crowe, it can be kind of a mystery as to what is happening with him. And he had a very long career in bluegrass music. He began to play professionally in the 1950s with Jimmy Martin. And when we look at the history of bluegrass from its creation in 1945, if you view it as starting at that date with Earl Scruggs joining Bill Monroe's band, this could be, the seminal album that was released in 1974 or 1975 called simply J.D. Crowe in the New South with Tony Rice, Ricky Skaggs, Jerry Douglas, and Bobby Sloan was like another big bang of bluegrass music. The combination of those musicians and the music that they played, the material that they played, but also more importantly, the way that they played it, redefined in a rhythmic sense, especially what the bluegrass sound could be all about. And so musicians like Alison Krauss were heavily influenced by that album. And you would not have much of the bluegrass that came later, the contemporary mainstream bluegrass, you would not have had without J.D. Crowe and the New South's that band leading the way. And we credit that recording because that's something that we can look at and play. That band, Jerry Douglas is also on that record. He was not in the band for very long. But that band played in the fall and winter at a nightclub in a Holiday Inn in Lexington, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And they played 4 to 5 sets a night from the fall, October, November through March or April, 6 nights a week. It was a very tight band, and there are recordings that exist out there. And aficionados, of course, love these live tapes. And if we go back a little bit historically, though, I think that JD's innovations, and this will hopefully be of interest to the guitar players who are listening, would not have been possible without the guitar players that he played with.
Yeah.
And I've done a number of interviews with Crow over the last year, and I'm just going to quote from some of the interviews.
Oh, sure. Go for it.
About what he talked to me about with the influence that he had, the influence that Jimmy Martin had on him. Jimmy Martin has the kind of a reputation of being an outrageous person and performer in the 50s and 60s, very important bluegrass musician. And I asked JD what the influence of Jimmy was on Crow's playing. And let's back up even a little bit further. Crow had the very good fortune of, as a teenager and a child, hearing Earl Scruggs play live. For a period, almost a year, the Flat and Scruggs Band based their performances out of Lexington, Kentucky. And they played a Saturday morning radio show. J.D. Crow's dad was a huge bluegrass fan. Bluegrass was a young genre at this point. This would have been the early 50s. And he would take J.D. They were farmers at that time. And they would be one of only maybe a half dozen people in the studio listening to Flat and Scruggs play their radio shows. And Crow has a memory of just sitting cross-legged right in front of Earl and looking up at him. And that's what got Crow hooked on the banjo. Can you imagine a more incredible way to get inspired? It's like being a jazz musician and hearing John Coltrane and McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. But his first professional experience came with this performer named Jimmy Martin, who had played with Bill Monroe. And like many other musicians who played with Monroe in the late 40s, early 50s, they started their own bands. As bluegrass moved from being just a style associated with one performer, just Bill Monroe, it was later Bill Monroe, the Stanley Brothers, Flat and Scruggs, the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers, and Jimmy Martin. And Crow told me this when I asked him about Jimmy Martin's influence. He said that Jimmy told him, "Now, Crow, you can't play like Earl and play with Jimmy's timing. Play the melody, but do your own thing." So I started doing that, and I got to listening to a lot of other music that I liked, and I started incorporating licks from other instruments to the banjo that would fit in certain songs that we were doing to be a little different. Crow was listening to country music like everybody else and also early rock and roll. He loved Fats Domino, and he loved lead guitar playing. He plays guitar, including electric guitar, and he loves saxophone solos. And there's a tune that Jimmy Martin recorded that many people have done subsequently, including the Bluegrass Album Band, which included Tony Rice and J.D. Crow, called Hold What You Got. And very unusual kind of lick kind of started the song out that Crow said he took from a rock and roll record, and it's just that's not atom splitting by jazz standards, but here was Crow playing something that was not roll based like Earl Scruggs might play, and Jimmy heard that lick and liked it, and now whenever you play that song, banjo players try to include that lick in it. But from very early on, Crow was incorporating, other influences, which any professional musician would do, even though Earl Scruggs' influence was so massive in the 1950s. And so Jimmy Martin's guitar style, I invite your listeners to try to find some video. And most of the video is late in Jimmy's career. It's different than Maybelle Carter's. It's different than Doc Watson's. It's different than, even Clarence White or Tony Rice. It's very wide sounding and big. And it actually, Jimmy Martin's guitar style is perfect for the banjo. And what Jimmy Martin wanted his banjo players to do, and Crow was among the earliest of a long line of important banjo players that played with him, including Bill Emerson and Tom Adams. And he wanted the banjo rolling all the time in a very steady beat. So these days, we talk about playing on the beat, or in front of the beat or behind the beat. I think in a bluegrass context, we wouldn't even be thinking about this if it wasn't for Jimmy Martin and J.D. Crowe. And it's not, you get the sense in listening, especially to Crowe's music after he left Jimmy Martin, there's not this kind of forward motion of playing ahead of the beat that you might hear in an extreme with the Stanley Brothers. It's right in the center of the beat. The timing is so solid. The next guitar player that we think of as being co-influential, if I might use that word, is Tony Rice. And J.D. Crowe brought Tony Rice into his band that was now called the New South. It was called the Kentucky Mountain Boys. And J.D. Crowe's career trajectory was he played with Jimmy Martin for a few years. He went back to Lexington, Kentucky and took day jobs, but played at night in the bars of Lexington, Kentucky that were frequented by college students. And that band played many nights per week and kept getting better and better and had musicians such as Red Allen, Doyle Lawson, very famous mandolin player who just recently retired. And they were called the Kentucky Mountain Boys. In 1971, Crowe changed the name of the band to the New South. And Tony Rice eventually joined. He came from California to play in a group called the Bluegrass Alliance, which was based out of Louisville, Kentucky. And that included, at various points in time, Sam Bush and Dan Crary. So between Lexington and Louisville, it takes about 90 minutes, I think, to get from one city to the other. There was a lot of bluegrass going on in the 1970s. And Crowe told me that he actually instructed quite a bit with Tony Rice, telling him what he wanted. And I'm sure that Tony took that ball and ran with it. And you can hear that, you know, when Tony, the live recordings with Tony Rice and then later Ricky Skaggs joined the band. By the way, the band, I indicated earlier, the band was playing at this Holiday Inn, and they were playing electric. They were plugged in. And the technology in the 1970s for that was horrible. And so Ricky Skaggs would only, you know, when the invitation went out for Ricky Skaggs to join the band, he would only do it if they returned to an acoustic format, which they did, to the benefit of all of us.
Let me pause you right there, because this Holiday Inn thing, and you're giving us like a bluegrass masterclass here, 101, which I totally appreciate, and this is amazing. I think most of our listeners, when they think of bluegrass, they think of the bluegrass sound, and they don't understand the minutia and the mavericks like JD. So Holiday Inn residency for multiple months, is that a normal thing? Was that just their recurring gig, the way folks would play the Saxon Pub in Austin, Texas or wherever every week?
I can only speak in terms of professional bluegrass, you know,
yeah.
but it was pretty unusual.
Okay.
Right. And then they would tour festivals in the summer.
Okay.
And I think that JD was still working his day job for part of that, although they did go professional. The pay was pretty good too. I mean, I think $100 a night per man.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty good money,
yeah.
Back for the early 1970s. Pretty unusual.
Follow-up question is, I know you were in your, I'm thinking 20s when that record came out, the New South Rounder 0044.
Yeah, yeah. First or second year undergraduate school at University of Virginia for me.
Okay. So what, I mean, was that, there was also, we talk about like the Newgrass revival, which was happening kind of around the same time.
Same time, yeah,
so,
for sure.
So paint the picture of just those two camps, I guess, because this was, we listen to these records now and everyone's just like, oh, that's a bluegrass record. But I think at the time there were pretty ballsy things that ruffled some feathers with the bluegrass purists and, kind of describe what the vibe was like and what that record did for you personally.
Great question. And for those of you, you know, young people, I think we think of the last 5 or 10 years as being, or maybe 15 years as being incredibly like explosive in terms of the innovation that's happening within bluegrass and within acoustic music in general, and the virtuosity of the current generation of pickers and the wide stylistic diversity. Every music will evolve according to the musicians and the listeners who love it. And I think that this, if you want to trace the sociological history of the music, you'd have to almost go back to the 1960s and a group called the Country Gentlemen. And they were based out of Washington, D.C., John Duffy, Eddie Adcock, Tom Gray, and Charlie Waller. And their audiences were urban. And they were out of the Washington, D.C. area. And they brought in what we would have called then folk music, music of the folk revival, into their repertoire. They were popular within bluegrass, but no doubt many people didn't like them, you know, because they weren't adhering to some of the rules that were established with this first generation of artists. And then we have to give credit to the Osborne brothers. In the late 1960s, Sonny Osborne told me that they didn't come to Nashville to copy Bill Monroe. And they were after wide mainstream success, and they forged a very successful blend of country music with bluegrass in 1971, just before all the stuff was happening with J.D. Crow's band. The Osborne Brothers were the Country Music Association's vocal group of the year. And, you know, they had Rocky Top. And Sonny Osborne told me that one weekend when he was driving from Knoxville back to Nashville, he turned on his car radio, all AM dial, right? And those, and he said that he went from left to right and every station was playing Rocky Top at the same time. And that it was selling 40,000 copies a day. Wow. Right? And so that's, you know, pretty amazing. But at any rate, so this had already begun. I think that in those days, folks like Sam Bush and the Newgrass Revival, and also what was happening in New York City with Tony Trischka and Pete Wernick, country cooking, were kind of as far outside as you could get. I think that the remarkable accomplishment with J.D. Crow was that they were able to win over everybody. And that had to do with, I think, the vocal approach, you know, and of course, Tony Rice was, you know, we all knew from the beginning when we first started to hear Tony Rice that this was something new and different. Mm-hmm. And this is before the David Grisman Quintet, like a year or two. So none of that had happened yet. Mm-hmm. but we also had, you know, the Seldom Seen, another Washington, D.C. based group that in some sense was an outgrowth of the Country Gentlemen, you know, but not entirely. But there were a lot of bands doing contemporary material. The banjo style had changed by that at that point because Bill Keith had introduced melodic style, which, you know, Scrugg style is based off of roll patterns. Or as my friend Marty Cutler says, we're analog arpeggiators. You know, and so banjo is in G tuning, and we're playing roll patterns, and we're grabbing a melody note here and there. Where melodic style allows you to play scales. And in melodic style, we developed by Bill Keith, Bobby Thompson, and also played by others, including a traditional player from North Carolina named Carol Best. That allowed you to play scales on different strings. And so suddenly we could play fiddle tunes, where, you know, fiddle tunes are note-for-note melodies, fast-moving, that would not have been possible in Scrugg style. So the players in these bands were incorporating on the banjo those techniques. Now, Crow learned a little bit of melodic style, but he never went that way. He remained his stylistic influence was always kind of an outgrowth of Scruggs with the infusion of his love of rock and roll and country music. So, mm-hmm. Now I want to talk a little bit about Tony Rice and J.D. Crow. And this is, again, from an interview that I did with Crow after Tony had passed away. And this is talking about a comparison of Jimmy Martin and Tony Rice. So Crow said, Jimmy played his style of rhythm and he played it great. It was there. Jimmy's rhythm was a cross between a country rhythm lick and a bluegrass lick. He had a full stroke rhythm. That guitar rang. It covered all of the strings and it was like one big sound. But when he was singing, you didn't hardly hear that guitar. He let up a lot. But then he put that emphasis on whoever took lead. Then that guitar was strong. I liked the way that was done, and I mentioned that to Tony, and he did the same thing. Tony, you know, was with Crow for a number of years, and he later, and so Crow went on to say, he definitely got better. This is Tony. He kept improving, and I could hear that. I'm a rhythm nut. I want good rhythm. The basis of any good music is the rhythm patterns, and I always stress that. There's timing, but there's a groove in that timing, and everybody has to be in that groove for it to work. Tony understood that very much. We didn't really have to work on timing that much because we knew what we were after. We knew what would match with the type of songs we were doing. Tony had a good ear about that, and I could hear him improving. His rhythm was something that none of the others had. There were other lead pickers out there who were pretty good, but they did not have the rhythm that Tony had. He had an unmatched hand when it comes to rhythm playing. It was so tasteful. He knew what fit. And so it's interesting that when Crow is talking about Tony Rice, he's talking about rhythm, which a guitar fiend may not be the first thing that occurs to, you know, to somebody who's a guitar fan. They would talk about Tony's melodies and his lead playing. And again, this is what the ineffable quality that cannot be explained in banjo tablature about Crow was: his timing. And we even struggle to put it into words. And I had mentioned earlier that Crow knew how to play very solidly on the beat. He didn't always do that. You know, oftentimes in bluegrass music, lead instrumentalists will get slightly in front of the beat for their leads and then pull back. And the job of the rest of the band is to stay in time and not speed up with them.
Oh, wow.
So there still is a beat. Mm-hmm. And you can hear this in large measure with a group called the Lonesome River Band, led by the banjo player Sammy Sheeler. The instrumentalists kind of push the beat a little bit. Tempo doesn't really increase, but then it adds excitement. And this started, gosh, with the Stanley Brothers, you know, and Flatt & Scruggs. But I met J.D. Crow in 1978 when Jimmy Goodrow was in the band on mandolin and Keith Whitley on guitar. And they had just released an album called You Can Share My Blanket, which was a combination of country and bluegrass. Luckily, all the bluegrass instruments were acoustically recorded, so the sounds are really, really good. And then our friendship, I was going to say survived, but that's not the right verb, grew over the years. And I hosted many workshops with him and several banjo camp weekends. And I also edited the only, what I would call, really authorized tab book that's available from AccuTab Publications. Authorized in the sense that I spent a day with him going over everything and getting it right. And I learned a lot. You know, I'm pretty good at transcribing, and so is the co-author, John Lawless. But when you're in a room with somebody, you know, you can see. And I just mentioned a couple things that were revelatory for me to be in an informal situation in a room with him. When I was learning banjo as a kid, I felt like I had... Once I'd played everything that was in the Earl Scruggs instructional book, I felt I knew everything there was to know about Scruggs style. But when you're in a room with somebody like J.D. Crow or Sonny Osborne, who has internalized this and has been to live performances and has been, you know, ruminating on what they can do with the general approach, it's so much, it's limitless what could be done. And you know, that was true of Sonny Osborne and also true of J.D. Crow, and his touch and tone were completely, completely amazing. I've got a funny story to tell that I should have told at the very beginning, but when I was learning to play in Norfolk, Virginia, when I was about 14 years old, I thought that the only thing that could be played in bluegrass music on the banjo was what was in the Scruggs book. That nothing else existed, because I didn't know about records. I didn't see any shows. You know, I was in a suburban area. And then I went to a concert featuring the old-time band, the Highwood String Band, that was put on by a local folk music society. First concert I've ever been to. I'd only been playing banjo for about 3 months. And there were a couple teenagers my age out in the parking lot. And they were playing the tune You Don't Know My Mind, which is a Jimmy Martin song with J.D. Crow on the banjo. And I heard a bunch of licks that sounded like Earl. That's kind of, you know, role-based. But then I later learned what Crow played for the D chord was. And I remember when Ronnie Barnes was the name of this Virginia banjo player who played Crow solo. I said, Earl didn't do that. And Ronnie said, that's right. There's this other guy named J.D. Crow. So at any rate, my first discovery of that was playing a lick that I thought was not possible on the banjo because Earl had never played it. Let me talk a little bit about, you know, Crow always referenced Earl in terms of being the most important influence. And one of the most attractive aspects of Crow's playing for many of us who like bluegrass is his playing on the Bluegrass Album Band recordings. And Crow told me on two occasions that these were his favorite recordings of his career, even more so than the famous Rounder 0044 album. And the Bluegrass Album Band project started as a Tony Rice solo album. Tony owed an album to Rounder Records, and he said rather than do something with a bunch of original compositions, it'd be easier to do a bluegrass album. Rounder wanted a bluegrass album. And so with Crow's help, they assembled the band, which was Bobby Hicks on fiddle, who had played with Bill Monroe back in the 50s, played with Ricky Skaggs for many years as well, Doyle Lawson on the mandolin. And Doyle had played with Crow in Crow's Kentucky Mountain Boys in Lexington, and had played with Jimmy Martin and then Tony Rice. And so this incredible group. And Crow talked about how they knew all of these standards that the Bluegrass Album Band recorded six albums, mostly of standards from Bill Monroe, Flatten Scruggs, Jimmy Martin, and the Osborne Brothers. They all knew that music like the back of their hands. They hardly had to rehearse it. And these days, those recordings are almost an encyclopedia for the learning bluegrass banjo player today. If you want to hear what bluegrass banjo is supposed to sound like, you could go to the Flatten Scruggs recordings, but also the Bluegrass Album Band recordings, and you'll hear a lot. For instance, on the vocal trios, Crow doesn't play anything at all, usually. There's texture changes at every point. But to talk about how Crow took what Earl would have done and made it his own, which is what any professional musician wants to do anyway. The first track on the first album of the Bluegrass Album Band is Blue Ridge Cabin Home, the Flatten Scruggs tune. And Crow's opening solo is in B-flat on the records, very much like Earl. A little punchier, a few more notes. Right here. Now, all of that is pretty much Scruggs stuff. You know, the second solo that he takes has much more of what we think of as being original about Crow style. So you could hear quite a few things there.
Yeah.
It's dense. You know, it's really, really exciting. And I'm looking at tablature here as I play, so I'm not even trying to capture the tone and the rhythm and the tempo, but much, much punchier, you know, kinds of things in that second solo. And that characterizes a lot of his bluegrass playing. The other thing that he did from very early on when he was playing on his own, though, was play a lot of country material. And not only things like Merle Haggard, but also Graham Parsons. And that involved a lot of kind of borrowing ideas from the guitar and pedal steel and chords. That kind of thing, which Sonny Osborne did, but Earl Scruggs did not do very much. And then another aspect of Crow style that is so cool is again, building off of what had come before from Earl Scruggs and Sonny Osborne, the idea of these bluesy kind of position licks. And there are great recordings of him playing the standard Train 45 where he kind of goes outside the beat and outside everything playing. Things like that. Yeah. And that's not, you know, he played as much better than I do. But that's another aspect of his playing that, but to me, as I think about his style, what is the truly incredible, remarkable thing that no one in my mind has captured? And we all try. I mean, Noam Pikelny said, you know, he realized he couldn't be J.D. Crowe, so he became Noam Pikelny, mm-hmm. you know, and Bela Fleck studied with J.D. Crowe when he lived in Lexington in the late 1970s, playing with a band called Spectrum. And I experienced this when I, the few times I've played with Crowe on a stage, where we're both on stage playing, is the placement of the timing. And people will talk about Crowe's separation of notes. And this, how do we do that? Well, that has to do with the setup of your banjo and your picks and how the picks are striking the strings, but it also has to do with your rhythm and how you're relating to the rest of the band. But I had an experience where I'd brought J.D. Crowe out to the West Coast for a music camp, and the other teachers were Ron Block of Alison Krauss and Union Station. He was playing guitar. Ron Stewart, who later played fiddle in J.D. Crowe's bands for many years, Missy Raines, Jim Hurst, Roland White, who's an all-star lineup. And we played a couple of shows in California after the camp. And David Grisman, who lives in that area, loves JD, has an old friendship. He just came out to the camp and hung out all weekend. And he joined us on stage. And as we got ready to play on stage, I said to myself, gosh, this is going to be really interesting. Because I played with David some. David is a really, really strong rhythm player. And so is JD. How is that going to mesh? And Ron Block, by the way, who is an excellent banjo player, was on guitar for this. So, and he's an incredible guitar player as well. And what I thought happened, at least if I were to characterize it, is that, and I've never heard David do this in any other context that I've played with him in, he deferred to JD. And it's unusual to have kind of a banjo player setting the rhythm, but to me, JD definitely did that. And we all fell into that groove. And I have to tell you that the space between the eighth notes was as big as the Grand Canyon. It was incredible. I've never experienced this in any other situation, and I can't describe, words fail me. And we got off the stage for one of these shows, and Ron Block, who has also studied J.D. Crowe very closely, said, that was amazing. I've never experienced any music like this, and just listening to J.D. And that is, you know, that's the one quality that is really incredible. On top of everything else that he did, was just, there's just something in that right hand and the way that he placed the notes, the duration of the notes, the punchiness of the notes, and his concept of rhythm. I don't know if that'll ever be equal. That's another really important reason why I hope we're listening to him for a long, long time to come.
Yeah. You've given us a whole bunch of homework. I'm going to try to put in the show notes as many of these links as I can. One of the things that you brought up, and I know Noam mentioned it too, and you brought it up just in this conversation, is the tone of JD. Now, I think when most of us civilians think of banjo playing, you're dealing with a percussive instrument, you're dealing with mostly metal finger picks. Tone seems like something where it's like the banjo dictates the tone. But clearly, if enough of you world-class players are saying like JD had the tone and the timing, he had some magic going on. Can you try to describe, is it all left-hand stuff? Is it just the nature of the attack? Like, what made that tone stand apart amongst you guys?
It's going to be largely right hand, but let me get some of the left hand out of the way by even offering something more mysterious. Crowe told me at one time that you could change the tone by how hard you fret something. Okay. What? I haven't experimented with that so much. Let's see. Here's a C chord. And if I... the note goes sharp a little bit. So I'm not sure what Crowe is telling me. Maybe the tone brightens up a little bit. You know, if there's a way for folks to respond on your blog, maybe mm-hmm. somebody I'll have to have a conversation with Noam about this. But yes, left hand is important in that he was very precise with the execution of what we call embellishments, mm-hmm. you know, slides, pull-offs, hammer-ons, very precise. So that is an important part in the rhythm. But I think that most of us as banjo players are amazed by the right hand. Okay. And one thing about Crow, he has a long hand. Not like somebody from another planet, but much longer than me. You know, Alan Mundy also has a very long hand. And to me, with the people that I've ever encountered, and even my students who have long fingers, they have an advantage. I don't know. It almost seems like it'd be harder, right? You watch Earl and it's very economical, the right hand, but Crow has this big, you know, long fingers. And I think that determined his tone early on. I mean, just the physicality determines part of the tone. Also, you know, the preference for these old banjos, people will argue whether that really means something, but it meant a lot to him. And he played these old Gibsons, and we also try to play with these older National finger picks and, you know, a variety of thumb picks. Later on, at the end of his career, he used these blue chip picks. But interestingly enough, when you study pictures of Crow over the various decades that he played, he had a lot, you know, banjo right hand is really, I think, for most of us, the most important aspect of playing. And it's a number of elements that all work together. And so one thing will affect another. So you can look at pictures of Crow early on, and he has this big long hand, as I suggested, and a real arched wrist. And so that is, those two things together are going to have the curved finger pick, which you can bend back or bend out. Mm-hmm. You know, you can experiment with the angle. Okay. And there's two ways to experiment with the angle. You could take the pick and move it around the end of the finger, or you could just simply push it out and have more of the pick at the end of the finger.
Sure.
And so this is why banjo players religiously study photographs and videos, and I'd slow the video down, stop it, you know, just to see what are the pick angles of Earl Scruggs and J.D. Crow. I'm not going to describe that, but I'll just let your listeners find that out for themselves. It's normal.
Okay.
Really normal.
Okay.
It's what everybody else would do. Not bent particularly far back out, not straight. But early on, the arched wrist really he could really peel paint off the wall. I've got a pretty arched wrist right now on this banjo, which is a pre-war flathead 3, which is one of the banjo kinds that Crow played. Got very deep. If I lower the wrist, it kind of closes it in a little bit.
Sure.
I'm not deliberately trying to prove the point. But it opens up. Now, Crow told me later on that he, towards the last maybe 10 or 15 years of his life, he changed his right hand. And this is another thing that banjo players do all the time too. We're always, you know, experimenting with setup and instruments and different picks and thumb picks and bridges and banjo heads and necks and all that. And he said that he arched his wrist less. So if you look at some of there's some great videos out there on YouTube from Kentucky Educational Television of a later Crow band that has Ricky Wasson in it that is amazingly great, and Ron Stewart on fiddle. Lots of incredible Crow banjo playing on it. And he's playing a Granada on many of these. You know, later in his career, he played a Granada, which is kind of a different beast than what we call a Gibson 3 or a 75. Those are mahogany banjos, nickel-plated metal, where a Granada is maple, gold-plated. And they do have different sounds. But J.D. told me later on in his career that he started to arch his wrist a little less. You could hear the sound change. So the later records, and when I mean later, I'm talking about maybe from the mid-90s forward. And they're all great, every single record. And there's a brand new record out that was recorded over the last 3 or 4 years, just called Crow Wasson, that I recommend. So another thing that banjo players will, you know, that Crow talked to me about was that he tries to have the picks meet the string with as little pick as possible. Kind of, so in other words, reaching the string at the end of the pick, kind of with a quick zing off and on. Now, Sonny Osborne told me the exact opposite, and he tries to play all the way down to the circle in the finger pick, which if you have a National pick or many of the Kaiser or Dunlap, that's really far down, and you have to dip your finger in. When I watch video, and again, I've stopped the video many times just to see every single frame, you know, I'm not sure that I think that Crow is playing really pretty much the way Sonny's playing, actually, getting a fair amount of pick on it. But again, I think the mental attitude is really interesting. When these great players tell me what they think they're doing, that means something to me. It's what they're, you know, that's what they're thinking about at any rate. But so that's what I've been experimenting with in the last couple months. You know, JD and I were talking quite a bit in the fall, and this is one of the things that he talked about. And he said, well, I try to play as close to the end as I can to get a snap. The other thing that people commented on is that it sounds like he might have been playing incredibly loudly. And of course, in a live setting or on television, you have microphones. But and I believe that early on in his career, he did play with a lot of power and volume. But later on, he didn't. And other players were surprised at how, when they would play with him, it wasn't really that loud, yet it was so powerful. And there was drive there. And that comes from the tone, too. So
got it. Do you know, it sounds like, I mean, you did talk to him more than most. Did that switch to the Granada and the different sound of the different banjo? Was that, I mean, obviously it was intentional. He had a fleet of banjos probably, but was he looking for a sound he wasn't getting before, or just kind of mellowing out, or what was it?
I think that so many of us, I'm 65, and of course JD was 84. So I'm of another generation, but I'm still old enough to have been primarily influenced by Earl Scruggs. Mm-hmm. And Crow and Sonny Osborne definitely were influenced by Earl Scruggs. And Earl Scruggs played a Granada. And I think that Crow, in the back of his mind, always, you know, wanted to get as close to Earl as he could with that banjo. And interestingly enough, the Granada that he played at the very end of his career was of this made, it was of what we call the batch, came out of the same batch as Earl's Granada. Mm. There are five of them, pre-war flathead, original five-string Granadas. And Crow bought one, you know, relatively late in his life. He'd played other Granadas before. Sonny Osborne had the second. Earl had the third. And I think a musician in North Carolina owns the fourth, and that the fifth may not have ever surfaced yet.
Wow.
Which is kind of amazing to think about. So not only at the end of his life was Crow able to play a Granada, he also played a Granada that was made on the same day as Earl Scruggs's with the same wood. And, you know, they used to put all these parts in these little cubby holes, you know. Well, that was Sonny's banjo there and Earl's banjo and JD's. Actually, I think Crow had number one. I'm not going to remember these numbers, but somebody will, who will post if there's a comment section. But I think that's why he probably went to a Granada. They do have a different sound. They have more sustain and not quite as much attack. And you certainly do change what you play in relationship to the instrument. And I am very lucky to own a pre-war, you know, mahogany three and two Granadas. And I can testify that there is a huge, for me, huge difference, huge in quotation marks. No one else cares except a handful of us. You know, my wife is a banjo player and I love her dearly, and she's a great, great musician. And I will call her into my office where I practice, and I'll have like a different banjo setup, or I'll try different picks and say, which one do you like better? And she always has an opinion, and she usually, you know, almost always wants, she prefers what I prefer to in my mind, but I must drive her crazy.
There's a lot of variables on a banjo. You know, if you got a flat top guitar, if it's in, you know, it's got a, if it's been set up properly, there's not a lot you can do with it. Banjos, it's like always, even just the skin and all that stuff, it's always changing.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of a nightmare, actually, if you take it too far. I encourage people to play. We have these instruments to play. One more thing I want to talk about Crow. You know, we talked a lot about his playing, how it evolved, how it changed, some of the elements that make it unique. We've touched on some of the recordings. I also want to talk about how he mentored so many great musicians, went through his band over 40 years. So, you know, Tony Rice, Ricky Skaggs, Jerry Douglas, Keith Whitley, Ron Stewart, Jimmy Goodrow, Phil Ledbetter, the great dobro player who recently passed away. And again, you know, the sound that got established, which in that mid-70s band, which no doubt was a collective in which everybody was active, but Crow was the leader of the band, that has set the definition of bluegrass rhythm now for the last 45 years. And that's incredible to think about. Of course, other things have happened in the music, very radical reconstructions of the roles of the instruments in many bands. But when we're talking about just mainstream bluegrass and contemporary bluegrass, you know, where the instruments are carrying out their traditional roles of accompaniment and lead, you know, that band set the standard.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Bill, this was amazing. You gave us, I mean, this was like a masterclass on J.D. Crowe. I love it. You do have that free, and I'll include a link, the free page on Peghead Nation, but are there more J.D. Crowe instruction explorations on there that are for folks if they want to dive in?
Yes, there are 6 other lessons.
Okay.
And if folks use the coupon code BILLE,
okay,
capital B, capital E, they can sign up. Still have to give the credit card information, but they get a free month.
Okay.
And you can download the tab and watch as many lessons as possible.
I love it.
And I wouldn't, you know, there's also the J.D. Crowe book from Accutab that's out there now. And that's a really great resource. So much great video too. So dive in.
I love it. I mean, this is, I was reading all the tributes. I've listened to the New South record, but I wanted to dive a little deeper and to kind of demystify this world for folks. Cause I know a lot of Fretboard Journal readers love bluegrass, but aren't as immersed as someone like yourself. So this was perfect.
Yeah. Hey, let me play one more thing for you.
You've given us a concert again, too, which I love. So.
Well, and again, I'm just sitting here in front of my computer and haven't warmed up much. But one of the greatest recordings that your guitar fans would like too, and maybe they already have it in their collection, is the first Tony Rice solo album, which was recorded in a very non-state-of-the-art studio in Kentucky. And it's just 4 band members, of which Crowe is one, Larry Rice on mandolin, Tony Rice on guitar. And one of the tunes they play is 9-Pound Hammer. And just like... The Blue Ridge Cabin Home, you know, it's a great study in Crowe's style. The first solo includes a lot of elements that make his twist on Scruggs style unique. Very subtle things like doing pinches instead of striking just single notes. So like Earl might go where Crowe went. Now, it's not a big deal. That big of a deal to anyone, except unless you're a banjo player. Crowe told me that he did that because the bars were so loud that he just, when you're kicking off a tune, you want to be heard. But his first solo, my transcription, you know, that 9-Pound Hammer, right? Yeah, that's the song.
Sure.
You've heard that before. So. Drive or note separation or anything like that, but that's kind of the straight melody.
Mm-hmm.
A few kind of really kind of cool little extra things, which bluegrass banjo players love that. The second solo, and this is 1973, is sounds like this. Hopefully I can play it. Take 3. I love that last lick that I blew. Awesome stuff.
Oh, well.
So, you know, and I do teach that on Peghead Nation as well, but you know, just incredible playing, and I miss him so much, you know, even though he hasn't been gone that long. And so sorry that we weren't able to do this course together, because there isn't any video instruction that he was able to do in his lifetime. So, all right.
Thank you, Bill. This was so helpful.
Welcome.
I hope you're having a good new year besides this JD news. And I look forward to seeing you in Seattle the next time you come through.
I want to get back on the road soon and hope to see you soon too. And congratulations on all the success with Fretboard Journal.
Thank you, amazing. Bill. That is our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I learned a lot. We should do more of these deep dives. Maybe that is one of the many things we'll pull off in 2022. Thanks as always for sharing this podcast with your friends or on Facebook or wherever you share stuff. Thanks for leaving us a review over on Apple Podcasts. And most importantly, thanks for being a part of our little community here and tuning in every single week.